Hey there, freedom fighters, both hands. Hi, my name is Andrew Warner. Hey, and another another set of hands there for my guest, Jason Shen. Let me go back to the beginning and start off by telling you, I'm Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And I love entrepreneurs. I love people who take risks. I love people who succeed after those risks. But people even who fail, if they take the frickin' risk, I admire them. Like the start of that Nietzsche book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he starts off by praising the man who was on the high wire and fell because he took a chance. I feel that's what Mixergy is about, and I feel that's what entrepreneurship is about, and I feel that's what our startup community is about. And so, when I read about the closing down of RideJoy, I was both disappointed and curious. And the founder of the company was good enough to not just say, hey, you know what, I'm walking away and embarrassed by this thing. But he said, as a team actually, I believe they said, we are going to teach other people what we learn from this so that we leave the entrepreneurship community better off than we found it, so that we pay back to the people who were there before us. And frankly, I also believe when you do that, you also help yourself by setting up a reputation for yourself, by also being the kind of person that other people want to work with in the future. Anyway, I read that post, I got disappointed, I got excited, I said, we have to get the founder on here. And as a team, we worked together to get him on. And as I said earlier, his name is Jason. Why am I mispronouncing Jason today?
Yeah.
Jason Shen. He is the founder of RideJoy, a community marketplace for long distance ride shares. I invited him here to hear how he built up the company and what happened afterwards. He is also the author of a book called Winning Isn't Normal, and he has a blog called The Art of Ass Kicking, and you can find the blog at jasonshen.com. One last thing before I get into the actual interview, this whole shebang over here is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer, which means if you're an entrepreneur, you need a lawyer, go to his site, walkercorporatelaw.com, and hire him. Jason, welcome.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Thanks for having me on. That little, spiel there about entrepreneurship just got me so pumped up. I think that your enthusiasm makes this so much fun and makes this exciting for me.
You know, when I started doing these interviews, the thing to do was to fling startups into the Deadpool. And it was like, hey, here's another guy in the Deadpool. I was never into that. I celebrate any entrepreneur who's going for it and I want to learn. And speaking of exciting moments, as you said, there was one exciting moment where you got a call from the founder of Y Combinator, Paul Graham. Do you remember where you were when he called you?
I remember exactly where I was, Andrew. So I was with my two co-founders and roommates at the time, Calvin Wang and Randy Pang, and we were at Calvin's mom's house. He grew up in Saratoga, which is in the South Bay of California, which is very close to the Y Combinator headquarters in Mountain View. So we had had our interview earlier that day. We had spent 10 minutes going through our big idea, and then we had to wait. And one of the great things about Y Combinator is that you don't have to wait very long. You get a word back that night or that evening. And so the day was going on. I remember one of our friends had come over, and I was talking to her, and I wasn't sure if the interview had gone well, so I was a little nervous and saying, you know, what would I do if I didn't get in, because I'd already quit my job. So I was pretty nervous, and me and Randy were sitting there too, and Calvin was in the house somewhere, and then, you know, the day is starting to get dark, and I see Calvin kind of coming out this side door. We're sitting outside. It's kind of warm because it's in, you know, March, April in California. He's on the phone. He's like, yeah. And Calvin's got a very sort of like flat tone, so you can never tell what he's really thinking or feeling. So he's got a flat tone. He's like, yes. Would it be okay if I put you on speakerphone? And I said, what? Who is he talking to? Why does he need to put him on speakerphone? And he puts him on speakerphone, puts it down on the table, and there's Paul Graham's voice coming out of the phone, and he's like, hey guys, you know, we'd like to fund you. And at the time, we had talked about among ourselves saying like, yeah, you know what we should do is we should ask for, you know, if he's going to ask for 7%, we should ask for 6% and negotiate a little bit. Nothing to lose, right? Nothing to lose. that moment where he offered 7% for, you know, $20,000, something like that, we were like, okay. He's like, right, do you guys need time to think about it? We're like, nope, we're good. And he's like, okay, great. We'll see you in, you know, June 1st. And so we hung up, and then we all just, like, gave each other, like, the biggest high fives in the world. You know, I was a gymnast. I was a gymnast for 16 years. I helped win a national championship. But I have to say that there has never been a particular single moment where I was as excited as this moment. And, you know, I think it's funny because things like Y Combinator, things like raising venture capital isn't necessarily something that we're supposed to celebrate because it's only a step in the journey. But then again, every step is only a step in the journey. Getting a customer, closing a deal, whatever it is, everything's a step, and that particular step was a big deal for us, so it was very exciting.
I can imagine. The pitch that you had was not Rye Joy as we knew it.
No.
It was something else, a combination of two different ideas. What was it?
Yeah, so what we pitched in the interview, what it might make more sense is that we started talking about our ideas for applying to Y Combinator in January. This is January of 2011. And we talked about all these different ideas, and eventually we felt that the idea that we all were really passionate about was something related to the feeling of nostalgia, the feeling of rediscovering something from your past that you forgot about, and then you re-remember and you re-love. And so the company that we applied, the idea that we applied to Y Combinator with was called Re-Love It. And what it would do is resurface content that you had previously shared or favorited or liked and brought it back to you at a moment when you hadn't expected it. So YouTube video you saw 6 months ago, you probably enjoyed if you watched it again, right? And so that was the idea, and we submitted that idea to Y Combinator. At the time, we heard back from them, and they said, we like you, we want to interview you, but we're not feeling this idea. We don't think that there's like a real market for it. We don't know who your customers are. So come prepared. We said, do you want us to like put together a demo, like write some code? And he's like, no, come prepared to talk about new ideas. And this was a week before the interview. So we said, crap, what are you going to do? We went through this whole, you know, thinking about all kinds of new ideas. It was like Saturday evening, you know, the interview's on Sunday. We still weren't sure. And we finally, one of our friends who had gotten into YC the last batch said, what did you like about the original idea? And we started talking about it. We started talking about ways that we could monetize the original idea. We had these ideas for how you could monetize it, like a calendar, a map of all your Foursquare check-ins with calendars and things like that. And then so we said, okay, what about photo books? Photo books are a physical thing. We could sell them. We could make money. And we could algorithmically generate photo books that were, you know, sort of using the same nostalgia algorithm. So we walked into the pitch, and we said, we are mint.com for photo books, which didn't quite make sense. It made sense in our head, like, oh, it sorts and organizes it for you automatically. But, you know, we went on to pitch it, and it sort of made sense to them. You know, what they tell you in Y Combinator is to prepare for the interviews is that you're going to get rapid-fire questions. And we didn't get that many questions, which made me a little concerned. There were some silences. No one was saying anything. There's Paul Graham. There's Jessica. There's, you know, Robert Trevor Morris. There's, you know, Sam Altman. And there's some silence. And at one point, Sam Altman was saying something about, or Paul Graham said, you could disrupt yearbooks. And I'd never thought about that. And I said, yes, of course. But no follow-up. And Sam Altman goes, oh, you know, I used to be the editor of my high school yearbook, and the software is awful, and we could totally use something like this. And Paul Graham and Jessica were like, oh, that's so great. You were the editor of your year. You're so talented.
They're saying that to Sam?
To Sam. And we're like, this is like a family reunion. Like, what's going on here?
So I've heard that happens in those pitch sessions, that they help you formulate the idea right there. I think the WooFoo guys said that that's what happened to them, that they didn't walk in with this idea. But why do you think they liked you so much that they invited you in even though they didn't like your idea? If you look at your resume, so to speak, or your application, what was it about you three that made them say, we want to invest in these guys?
Right. So, I can talk a little bit about our application, and then I can also tell you about what he told us, because when we got in there, A week after, you know, a week after we showed up to YC, we decided, or the day after we showed up to YC, we said we wanted to change ideas. And then we started ideating, and we asked him at one point, why did you fund us? And he said, let me check my notes. And he goes back and he looks at his notes. He comes back, he says, super enthusiastic founders fund for the new idea. Which at the time we thought meant fund for the idea we had pitched in the interview, because we had, you know, pitched this new idea from our application. And then a year later, we found out, because they wrote a book about our batch in YC, the launch pad, by Randall Strauss, that actually fund for the new idea meant fund for the idea that they're going to have after they get into YC and decide that the idea they just pitched us is no good. So
you mean for the idea that Paul Graham and the team had for...
No, fund for the idea that we would come up with next. The next idea, not even the one that we were talking about.
Oh, fund for that. Gotcha. Right. Yeah. So it was the enthusiasm. There was nothing in your background that made them say they built this so they could do... Was it what you were doing in college with Gumball Capital?
Yeah, so I think that there was there are some interesting things about our background. So Calvin and I both went to Stanford, and Calvin was a computer science major. I was a biology major, but we first got in touch when, during my junior year, I had gone through this awful knee injury, and I was out of gymnastics. I wasn't spending as much time in the gym, and I got involved in a group of students who were working on a project related to microfinance, which is the sort of act of providing financial services, especially small loans, to really, really poor people who often don't have collateral, and it makes a big difference in their lives. And this was just kind of getting started. Kiva.org, which many of you have heard of, was just getting off the ground, and we were excited to sort of do things related to that. And so me and Calvin met, and the student project turned into this full-on 501c3 nonprofit that I became a co-founder and the executive director of, and we ran these challenges across college campuses to raise money for microfinance. So that was our first interaction, our first time together. So in a way, we kind of started a startup, you know, a nonprofit startup while in college. And so that I think that they really liked that.
And the idea was you gave each team some money and you challenged them to see how much more money they could raise.
That's
using
right.
This, like, you're funding them and asking them to do it. One of the cool ideas that I heard that you guys came up with was, or the students who were participating came up with, was the Tower of Quarters, where students would pile some quarters and they would challenge other students to come and add to this pile of quarters.
They were trying to make the case that they could create the world's tallest tower of quarters in this 1 week period. And, you know, I think that worked because quarters are such a small amount of money, and you can see them stacking up, and after a while you see this stick get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's kind of exciting to be a part of it. They ended up having a stick that was like 11 feet tall. You know, not the record, not the world record by any means, but certainly impressive when you just look at how many quarters that is. And it was, you know, a good chunk of change, several hundred dollars when we all, you know, was all told. And
who raised the most money?
I think for that challenge, that was run at Stanford, and I think they were one of the winners. I think that actually there was like a high school or a set of high school campuses that raised, you know, upwards of $1,000 in their challenge. And so that was pretty impressive. I think what really stood out is the fact that there's so much creativity happening with these students, and we had to give a lot of trust. We would mail $27 in cash to all the, you know, they would tell us how many teams they had, and then we'd mail them cash in envelopes, which I think mirrored the sort of thing that was happening in microfinance, where we were, they're making loans to the poor, which people would tell them, forget it, that money's as good as gone. But, you know, when you lend in groups, and there's this reputation, and there's like, there's this community effort, those loans actually are a pretty good deal, you know. So
I love this idea a lot, and I can see how it brings out people's creativity. I can see why that would make the Y Combinator team feel more enthusiastic about you. All right, you get
so,
in.
So yeah, and then the tie in Randy, me and Calvin started to live together in San Francisco after we graduated, and we had one roommate who only stayed for a couple months and wasn't quite working out, and then we got really – serious about finding someone we thought was really great. And we went through, you know, a whole series of interviews and ended up finding this guy named Randy, who was a recent Cal grad, EECS, electrical engineering, computer science. And so we lived together for a year before we decided to apply to Y Combinator. And that during that time, we became friends, you know, and we talked about that in the application process, that we, you know, had all kinds of discussions. We fought and we made up and we figured out how to work together well.
Okay. I like that you keep looping them in. I don't mean to ever discount the other co-founders who are not doing the interview here, sure. But if they're not doing the interview, forget them.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. But I try to keep it simple. And I know sometimes when I listen to podcasts and interviews, I have a hard time keeping everyone straight in a story.
Understood.
So I try to keep it simple for the audience. But you're right. I don't want to ever leave out the other important people in the team. And Calvin and Randy are just as good as here. You then get in, the three of you, into Y Combinator. Your idea chucked out the window. Where does this new idea that becomes RideJoy come from?
Yeah, so we were a little frustrated when we realized that we couldn't do this idea. But at the same time, we knew that we wanted to do something that all three of us were excited about. And that's why I bring them up so often, is because so much of what we did was sort of decided together. And so we decided together, we don't want to do this book printing idea. It's not software. It's like a physical business. We're going to have warehouses. We're going to be shipping. We don't want to do that. So, okay, I think the one thing we could really get behind was this idea of Airbnb. We loved Airbnb. So many things to love. The community elements of it, you know, the fact that we're allowing people to make money, you know, the connections that are being made, travel. And so we started looking at things like so Airbnb's got the like biggest money making marketplace that hasn't emerged yet, which is this space marketplace. But what else is there? Is there, you know, maybe physical, like skills is one of them. Maybe like expensive goods was one of them. One idea that we played around with was camera lenses, you know, and lending those around. But I think the car, the rides idea was something that evolved from something we had thought about before the interview. We had originally thought about this idea of driving down to Saratoga. So Calvin lived in Saratoga, and he often was trying to get rides with his friends because he went to high school. You know, he had high school friends who lived in San Francisco. They're driving down 101. For those of you who don't live in California, it's kind of a pain. It's Caltrain. The train system's not good. So you want to get a ride, but it's tricky. So we ditched that idea the first time around because he said, is anyone going to be willing to spend enough of their time to pick somebody up for like $5? You know, it didn't seem like economically it made sense. So we kind of gave up on that idea. But we returned to it after we were kind of messing around on Craigslist. I think we were looking at some stuff for camera lenses on Craigslist. And somehow, I don't remember how, we found the ride-sharing section on Craigslist, which I did not know existed until that moment. We checked it out. We saw that there were like 100 to 150 posts every single day in the San Francisco Bay Area. And when you are thinking about ideas, you want to look for what we call proxies for demand. And the idea that there are 100, 150 people every single day logging on, posting on Craigslist, which, by the way, had no real filtering mechanisms, no maps, no authentication about who they were, no payments, none of these things, and yet people were willing to put up all this effort to do it. There must be more people who would do this if there was a better system in place. And that's right. What we thought.
That makes sense. And that took you, you just expressed it in maybe 3 minutes, but it took you about 3 weeks to come up with that idea within Y Combinator. Is there pressure while you're in the group with all these other people around you building so fast, having ideas? Some of them actually walked in with ideas.
Some of them walked in with businesses that had been running for a year before they even came in. So
did you feel any pressure?
Oh, yeah. We felt a lot of pressure. I don't think it came from the partners. They were very, as soon as we said we wanted to change our ideas, I mean, they expected it. So they were like, okay, great. You know, and then, but we were internally freaking out because Y Combinator is a 10-week program, and we were eating up 30% of our time sort of sitting at home, Googling things, tweaking, you know, messing around with gadgets, trying to like get something that we could get started on. And so there was a lot of pressure. And I honestly think, and sort of we'll hit on this later, but I honestly think that if we hadn't had that pressure of the 10 weeks, we probably wouldn't have settled on Rajoy, but we did because it was like the best of what we had based on the time and the situations that, you know, we put up pressure on ourselves.
All right, so now you've got your idea. How long does it take you to build the first version?
So it took probably another 3-4 weeks to get a V1 up. Let's say June 21, we settled on Ridejoy. I think we launched BurningManRides.com August 1st, something around
of
there.
2011.
Of 2011.
Okay.
And so what we thought was, okay, how do you jumpstart a marketplace like this? The only way to do it is to pick a niche and just kill it. And so we had two that we talked about. One was like SF to LA, and the other was Burning Man. Calvin, my co-founder, had gone to Burning Man the year prior, and he knew that this festival in the deserts of Nevada, 50,000 people go. There are no, you know, real sort of systems to get there. Everyone's kind of sharing rides already, and they don't have good mechanisms to do that. We could get in there. So we looked into it, and we decided this is it. This is where we're going to make our mark. You know, this is our D-Day. So we launched BurningManRides.com and had it very much sort of culturally fitting the Burning Man ethos when we launched.
And I see it. I mean, the site is still up, and right. I've got a sense of what the business is going to be from this. I think you updated it since the first version.
Sure, yeah.
But essentially, that's it. How much programming went into matching people up?
So we didn't, in our initial version, match people up at all. We just had buttons that allowed you to post either a ride offer or a ride request. Okay. And then we allowed people to look at them, you know, look themselves for what they were trying to find. You could do some basic filtering about like where you were and where you're trying to go. But, you know, it's just a giant list. And we had it sorted by date. So there were enough things there that you were at least not having to read like hundreds, because ultimately, we got something like 1,600 people who signed up and 1,200 rides posted on the site. So it got pretty big in just a couple weeks. But, you know, with that filtering in place, it was manageable. Okay. And much better than previous sort of systems that existed.
And a step beyond where Craigslist was because of the filtering. I think you even had photos, right? So people can see each other.
That's right. There's a Facebook integration. So you automatically got those photos and you could even... Yep.
And speaking of Facebook, you needed to, once you launched this, you needed to market it and get people to come to the site, right? And what did you do on Facebook to help grow
it? Right. And so, you know, we got pretty lucky, I would say, that the Burning Man Facebook group sort of noticed what we were doing. We were out there. We were trying to tweet at people. We were trying to, you know, get in the forums. And they saw this and they, you know, just linked to it on their page, which is, you know, has 250,000 likes on it. And so immediately it got that pickup. It got maybe 1,000 or 2,000 likes by the end of the whole thing. And so we were really lucky to get that and to have a chart that had any kind of up and to the right. This is what we always talk about.
Suddenly just took off. But you weren't charging, right? It was just...
No.
Okay.
We were very concerned about sort of stepping on the toes of the Burning Man culture, which is very much a gift economy. Some money does exchange hands, but it's fairly rare, and we felt that would hurt our chances of having this service be promoted or used. So we didn't charge anything.
And people could not charge each other?
Nope. They had to do it with cash.
Bare minimum. You were just up and running. Things are looking good. You now go into demo day, right?
That's right.
Why did you turn a cartwheel before you spoke on mic at demo day?
You know, we were talking about how our batch was 63 startups, and that was the largest batch that had ever been in Y Combinator to that point. It was like a 2-day event. There was like 3 different breaks. It was a long endeavor. And so a lot of the feedback, when we watched rehearsals, was that it was so slow, so boring. You get zoned out. And so, you know, I think we as a company, we're always good at finding little ways of standing out. And this was just one of them. I was the one who was going to be doing the pitch, and you know, someone suggested, like, maybe you should, like, throw out a cartwheel. I think it was a joke at first, but then we were like, no, yeah, we should really do this. And so when I went out, I threw out a cartwheel. You know, the other person's walking back, I'm walking in, and I just throw in a cartwheel, which kind of throws everybody off. And I think I ad-libbed a little something. I said, like, you guys looked a little tired over there, so I want to wake you all up. And then I, you know, launched into my pitch. But people did not forget the cartwheel.
You raised $1.3 million. What is the best thing that you did, the most effective thing that you did for raising that money? Because there's so many things that went into it, and I want to move on to the business, but I think maybe we can cover one thing that you did.
Yeah. So I'll tell one story, which is that we were pitching Owen Venata, who was early at Amazon, Facebook, you know, leader at Zynga, and we had we were telling him about our ideas. It was me and Calvin pitching together, which often people would say, don't do that, have one person pitch, but we want to do it together. We did it. We're telling him about our ideas. He's looking a little glazed over, not that excited, and I said, wait, let's stop. Why do you invest in companies? What makes you excited to invest? And he says, you know, I don't think of myself really as an ideas guy. I don't really know about the future, but I try to invest in people. When I saw Mark Zuckerberg, I wanted to work for him, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? Let me tell you about me and my buddy Calvin and how we started a nonprofit together. I was a national champion gymnast. I know about team, you know, just totally changed the pitch. He signed that day. He didn't have time to meet again. He's like, okay, let's do it. And, you know, and so that was one, you know, little piece of a bigger journey for sure.
All right. Facebook gets people into the Burning Man site, burningmanrides.com. It's time to keep on growing. You got some money in the bank. You got an idea that works, that's been validated through Craigslist. It's time to get users. You go back to Craigslist with a hack. What do you do?
Right.
What's the first thing that you do?
The first thing we did is we said, okay, there must be a way to sort of insert ourselves into this stream. When you think about traffic and growth, it's coming from somewhere. It has to come from somewhere else. There are sort of streams that exist. There's the Facebook stream, there's the Twitter stream, and then there's like the Craigslist stream of people who are on Craigslist. And we wanted to find a way to exist there and draw some people in without. And Craigslist, similar to Burning Man, has a bit of an ethos of we don't want commercial activity, we don't want people who are just there to try to make a profit. So we had to be careful. And what we decided to do was come up with a calendar because one of the things that, you know, I cold called about 50 people who ride-shared on Craigslist who had left their phone numbers over time and had conversations with them. And one of the things they said was really challenging was finding rides that match their ride, because some people would say Thursday, some people would say 2/17, some people would say next week.
So it's not enough to say I'm going from San Francisco to LA. I need to also, or sorry, it's not enough to find a ride from San Francisco to LA. It also needs to be on the date that you're going. And by calling people up, you discover that. Did it take a long time, a lot of phone calls to figure that out, or did you find that pretty soon?
I mean, I think that it was important to do a lot of phone calls because we were fairly new to this space from a personal usage perspective. I think that one of the things we validated quickly, we thought the number one problem would be flaking, would be people not showing up. And we actually quickly found that that was not a problem, that people made their arrangements and people showed up. So that happened pretty quickly, but I think it was good to do more just to really get that broader perspective.
Okay.
So we did this hack where I looked at all the rides in the last 3 days. I put them into a spreadsheet with a link to the URL, sort of where it's going, tried to figure out the date myself, and produced this little document that we pasted into Craigslist, and we said, list of rides going out of San Francisco. And we had a little letter at the top that said, hey, my name is Jason. We just wanted to help the rideshare section. We're working on a little project. Check out this calendar we made. All true things. Maybe not everything that we, you know, were doing, but all true. And then we posted this calendar. And we waited. And I said, oh, email me if you have any feedback or thoughts on this. And we immediately started getting a lot of messages. People were emailing back saying, oh, this is so great. I love that you made this. This is what the rideshare section needs. It's so hard to find rides. And we said, okay, lots of people are seeing this, because if you're going to write a message, you know, conversion rates are crazy. So if three people write you a message, 300 people looked at it, yep, at least, you know. So we knew that this was something. And then so we started to find ways to automate the system. We hired one of our users part-time to start to collect those rides on Craigslist.
And by the way, Jason, were you linking two posts on Craigslist, or were you at this point moving some of those entries to RideJoy?
So right at that time, it was only links back into Craigslist.
Okay.
And then what happened over time is that we built a web scraper that scraped the rides, collected them. We had we started to set up a virtual team in Vietnam that would sort of like read it and sort of, was it a ride offer, a ride request, what day was it, and sort of like that understanding what it, parsing it. And then we were inserting it into our own database.
I see. So taking all the Craigslist posts from all over the country, or was it West Coast at this point?
At this time, it started in San Francisco, but as we expanded, we started scraping all the cities that we were trying to serve.
So you scrape it, you have these guys help you out by making sense of the data and putting it into RideJoy. Now, RideJoy essentially has the same data as Craigslist, but in a much more organized way, much more user-friendly way. And so now you go back and you keep posting those calendars, but time the links are going back to RideJoy.
That's right. So we would have the links go back to RideJoy. It was almost like an iframe, so you could go back, you know, you're just seeing it as it was in Craigslist. We also had, people eventually started to post their own rides, right? And then we had the RideJoy rides right there too.
And they were posting into Craigslist also.
And so then, yes, additionally, we built functionality where after you posted a ride on RideJoy, we said, hey, why not also put it on Craigslist to add additional eyes on it? And we sort of did something where almost everything was filled out and all you had to do is press send. They still press send. But we sort of drafted an email for them that said, hey, I'm a 20-something-year-old, friendly 20-something-year-old who's looking to go to – and we just sort of wrote it all for them based on what we already knew, what they told us.
Gotcha. So they didn't even have to – if they clicked an email link in Craigslist, they'd have to type out that kind of message and basically sell themselves as good ride companions. But on RideJoy, you've pre-populated most of it based on what you knew. All they had to do is hit a button. It pre-populates your email and adds a couple of other things, including a link back to RideJoy. Boom.
That's right.
I see what you're doing. A lot of this is, as the original idea was, inspired by Airbnb.
Yeah. The Airbnb definitely did a variety of things on Craigslist because subletting is so massive. They did the post back. I don't think they did any kind of calendaring. The one thing that they did that we definitely did not do was pretend to be someone who was just a regular person and then message other people who had sublets and said, hey, you should check out this cool site. You know, we didn't do that, and we felt that that was like disingenuous. And we felt that we were trying to be clear that this was, we said, rides brought to you by RideJoy and things like that. So
how much of Airbnb's story is shared in Y Combinator, where much of this story developed? Are they talking to you about it? Are other people saying, here's what Airbnb did, you should learn from your fellow Y Combinator startup?
I think some of what they were doing had been publicized in various websites. But, as part of Y Combinator, there are these Tuesday sessions where different entrepreneurs come in. In our batch, you know, Max Levchin of PayPal came in. And then the Airbnb folks did come in, and they spent a really long time with us. You know, they went through the story from beginning to where they were then. And I just remember thinking, man, they deserve all the success that's coming to them, because they were, you know, at the bottom of the barrel at various points. And so, it was very inspiring. And that was, it was much more about inspiration than particular tactics, I would say.
I got to tell anyone in the audience who's listening to this, they should go back and listen to the Mixergy interview with Airbnb, where you hear that story early on. I mean, they were so new. I remember emailing, I think it was Joe, saying, Joe, Are you, you know my site, you know the interviews here. Is Airbnb big enough yet for us to do this interview? And then hearing back, and they back then were so much smarter than I even realized. They were, but you can see it in the interview. You can see it in the way that they even approached me. I think they were one of those entrepreneurs who even gave me the message, the ideas that they were going to share with the audience, because they were so aware of what worked for them and so determined to talk about it. Things like messages that are now a little better known, like do things that don't scale. But the stories behind it too that they shared are fantastic. They're a great company to learn from.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, definitely.
You guys should go check it out on Mixergy. Just type in Airbnb and listen. Let me do a quick plug, because I think it relates to this next thing that happens to you because of Coachella. A lawyer comes in and, well, we'll find out what happens. But first, I should talk about the lawyer that I'm that sponsors Mixergy, as I said earlier, on Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. If you have a lawyer who doesn't understand your space, he's not going to understand some of the things that happen, like what you'll hear in a moment, and freaks out, you're doing yourself a disservice. You need a lawyer who understands where you're going. You need a lawyer who understands your environment. You need a lawyer who can help you figure out where you're going and how. This is with a whole lot of going, I guess, because it's rideshare. When you get started, if you don't set your company up right, it's going to make it harder for you to raise money, harder for you to sell it. It's going to be harder for you to add funders, partners. It'll be harder for you to break up with them unless you do it all right from the start. If you want to do it right from the start, check out walkercorporatelaw.com. Talk to my friend Scott. And if you don't, there are tons of other lawyers. Just type into Google search lawyer for startup or lawyer I need. What is it? Just lawyer, and you'll see how many out there. They're not all good. I recommend Scott. This thing that happened to you, you said, all right, Burning Man is working.
Yeah. So we started to do partnerships with other events. And so we would go out and I had this big list of festivals, music festivals, art festivals, yoga festivals. And we were just going out there and I'm calling them up. I'm sending them emails. I'm trying to get them to basically, we would make a custom page for them, ridejoy.com/Tadasana Yoga Festival. And they could direct their attendees there. And we were basically saying, we'll build you a free rideshare portal, and your users will love it, and we'll get new users. And it's a sort of a free trade, and we're going to do a lot of work, and you just have to promote us. And so that worked to varying degrees. I think the uptake wasn't always right. And then when Coachella came around in April of 2012 at this point, and we said this is one of the few festivals that's as big as Burning Man, you know, something like 40,000 people over. I think that was the first time they split it up in two weekends. And so we built out, we did the full-on thing. We did the CoachellaRides.com, and we had a big picture of the festival, and we just started promoting. We said, you know what, those guys, they're not going to want to work with us. They're too whatever. We're just going to promo it ourselves. We can run ads against Coachella. You know, we know people who like Coachella. And so we started doing that. And then we got this first an email and then a phone call from one of the lawyers of, I forget, it's like Lionsgate or whatever the parent company is, Golden Voice or something. And they said, you need to take this site down. And we said, why? And they said, this is a trademark. You're infringing our trademark. He was good enough to say something like, I understand what you're doing is helping people, but you can't run this site anymore. So that was that was a little concerning, and we were getting some uptake, so we didn't want to shut it down unnecessarily. We contacted the Y Combinator legal team that, you know, it's just to get a little bit of advice. I agree that if you don't have a lawyer that understands what you're doing and trusts, and that you really trust and can count on, it's very scary. And he was up in arms. He said, that's ridiculous. They can't do that. And that gave us some confidence. We looked into it and we realized that Coachella is both the name of a festival and a place, a location.
Of course. You know what? That didn't even occur to me. Of course. Right. Of course. Just like you can say ride to LA, you should be able to say ride to Coachella.
Right. And so what we did is we had this banner that said, and that it was a picture of the festival, and it had the words, Coachella is a 3-day event, blah, blah, blah. We just changed it. We had a picture of the desert and said Coachella Rides, and we said Rideshare to Coachella, a part in the southern part of California that's this many acres, that's home to wine vineyards and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we didn't do anything else. Didn't contact him. He called us back. We said, you know what? Actually, we don't have a problem because we're not ride sharing to Coachella anymore. We're just ride sharing to the area.
To Coachella Valley.
And he was kind of pissed, but, you know, nothing happened. And I think he realized that there's nothing that he could really do and it would be too late by the time he did anything. So that was our little dodge out of that mess.
And that was effective for you because, like you said, you could buy ads against it. The only way you could afford to buy ads is because you were starting to generate some revenue, right?
We were starting to generate a little revenue. We had implemented by that time a payment system. And, you know, the way it worked is, and one of these challenges that you face when you're building a startup is how much do you try to conform to the existing behavior that your users have, and how much do you try to kind of push them into a different way of doing things. And often the challenge is also you have this core group of existing sort of early adopters, and then you've got the mainstream market, and they sometimes have different styles. So the early adopters like to do things in cash. Mainstream market, much more comfortable with credit cards online. So what we did was we split the difference. We said when you posted a ride, you could accept money either cash or credit card, cash only or credit card only. And we set it in the middle. So we said, you know what, you have options. And amazingly, a lot of the people would actually switch their link over to cash only. And we were like, what are you doing? Don't you want to get paid up front? And they said, similar to the no flaking thing, they said, I know I'm going to get paid. I'm going to drive to a gas station and they're going to pay me right there. It's not going to be a problem. And then, you know, the new users, the users who used to paying online, they got the credit card, they would do it. But it was a fairly small portion of our total user base. So it wasn't a lot, but we wanted to build that traction, and investing in a little bit of advertising was worth it.
That makes sense. And so if they were doing cash, you weren't going to take a cut of that. If they were doing credit cards, then you take a processing fee.
That's right.
Got it. And were your ads effective? Were they cost effective?
I mean, I think cost effective was definitely not cost effective if you look at the idea that, you know, you sign up, you know, let's say it was like $1.50 per user. The chances that they were then going to post and then going to find someone who matched and then pay with a credit card that, you know, the number, you know, it just didn't work out that way. And so that was not something that would have been scalable for us. But with this marketplace, and this leads to some of the challenges of why this did not succeed, was the fact that this was not a frequent use case product. If we had acquired this person one time and maybe they posted and didn't find a ride, but they're going to post again tomorrow, the day after, or next week, or, you know, a couple times in the next month, then they probably would match eventually and they probably would, you know, make us money and make us more money over time. But you might go to Coachella and you might not need another ride for 6 months.
Right.
And so that was a real challenge. And we also felt that it was a sink or swim proposition, like a shark. You know, if you're not active, then you are, you know, quickly the volume of rides on the site goes to very low. You get a reputation for having no rides on the site and no one goes there, and game over.
I see. By active meaning this community isn't going to keep perpetuating itself. You have to keep bringing new people in. And it is, I see. So that's one problem. Another mm-hmm. problem is many people wanted to pay cash, as you said. Another mm-hmm. problem was I'm on the site right now, ridejoy.com/Coachella. And I see someone offering a ride from Palm Springs to Coachella for $5, from San Diego to Coachella for $20, Los Angeles to Indio for $25. It would cost me. Tonight I'm going to be doing these interviews until about 9 o'clock. I will get into an Uber or Lyft or sidecar. It will cost me maybe $10-$15 to get home. These guys are charging for so much further. And that's like a 4-mile ride for me.
That's right.
This is unreal.
Yeah, and that was one of the weird dynamics about it is that short distance rides can be really lucrative. Medium distance rides are maybe not worth it. And then long distance rides sort of become worth it, especially if you stack your car, right? So there's some people who will go and fill a car, four seats, $45. You know, they just made $180. And, you know, you can start to see why there's some economic value in there, but there's a lot of work involved as well. So the problem is that you have to look at the alternative, which is a bus, right? And a bus probably is going to get you for $25, you know, whatever it was, like San Diego to Palm Springs or something, it's probably around that, you know? And so there's some challenges on either end of it, but, you know, it's comparable.
So you're still trying to figure out revenue, but it's okay. You know, you just want to get some kind of revenue model in there.
Mm-hmm.
The big focus is on getting more users and getting continuous users. Craigslist seems like, of all the things you did, the most effective.
Yep.
Was it effective? Do you have any memory of the numbers that you were getting from Craigslist?
Well, so let's see. Like, we basically estimate that it's about 50% of our new user growth. We were growing maybe 25-30% a month for 8 months straight up through August. At one point, we were getting something like 300 ride posts a day. I would say that maybe that's like, let's say that's like 200 users or 200 users posting those 300 rides. Does that make sense? Let's say it's about the same number of users, because some users don't post, some users post more. So 300 new users a day. So that means, you know, 150 users coming out of Craigslist every single day. For, you know, a period of time.
All right. So 150 new users, meaning people posting rides?
Signing up for the service, and then, you know, some number of them are...
Post and some take.
Right.
Or I see.
Or, Yeah, 300 new users, 300 new users a day, because 300 rides a day, 300 users a day. And they were about we were calculating it was about $1 to convert from Craigslist to Roger if you estimate the whole operation that we were running. You know, it was free because we weren't paying any money, but we were paying people that...
I mean, the scraping operation, the data entry, and so on. Okay, so you're looking for more places. You launch an iPhone app.
That's right.
And one of the challenges with the iPhone app was too many features. What extra features kept you from launching it right or made you feel like it was too much?
Yeah, so we sort of put all our thoughts about UX into this iPhone app, which we thought sort of you get into this mindset where you think something's going to save you and then you want it to be perfect. You know, our app, I still think, is one of the most beautiful rideshare apps on the site, but it did a lot of things. So one of the, there are the natural things that you could do on the site, which were like post a ride and message people and kind of search. And then we were starting to think about, did we want to have a search on the app or not, or did we want to do something else? And we decided to do more of a matching system. So you would post, everyone had to post a ride. No one was allowed to search. And that had to change, you know, you had to change some of the dynamics of your app to do that. When you posted a ride, you could include things like have snacks, have Wi-Fi, you know, preference for a safe drive. You could do things like I'm a safe driver or whatever. So that those added these little UI elements. We had an integration in Card.io, which allowed you to take your credit card through a picture of your credit card, which is very cool technology. But, you know, was it strictly necessary? I don't know. And then we had a sort of section that was called like popular destinations, where we were trying to give that feel. We have this similar thing called hubs on the site, where you could kind of go into a hub, like an SFA area hub, and see the activity. So you could feel something happening. And we, you know, iterated a couple different times before we came up with a system that we liked for. So we kind of just repolished and reworked the app again and again until we, you know, felt it was ready to go, and we also felt like, God, we got to get something out there. So that took long. You know, we probably should have shipped in April. We ended up shipping in August.
Oh, wow. Okay. I can see how adding a Wi-Fi option might be a little much, for example. Mm-hmm. How many people need Wi-Fi in the car? I can also see in one of the screenshots here, you allowed people to indicate whether they had an auxiliary connector or not.
Right. Yeah. We started to have a little fun with it, and, you know, I think that that was – That's fine generally, but you know, as in the strategic point of view, is not what we need to do.
Okay, but I see why mobile made sense for you, right? Everything's moving to mobile, but specifically rides are. Well, I'm thinking of examples like if I had to use my computer for Uber, it just wouldn't work, right? I'd have to come back to the computer and look for a car and then go downstairs. So I see mobile. You made the right decision to get into mobile. How did it work out?
Well, we teed up a lot of press, and the press went well. So we had, you know, six different pieces right about us. We put up, we invested in some sort of in-app ads that, you know, pay for downloads, and we were able to kind of juice our metrics to the point where we could be like top 25 in the App Store for free apps, which is, you know, a whole process. And I don't
even
know how.
How did you juice it? What did you do?
So we used a service called I can't remember. They're like one of the biggest ones out there where you basically you pay something like around a dollar to like a couple dollars per download, per install. And the install only counts if they open the app one time after they've downloaded it. And it's usually in some kind of game where they have coins in the game, and you can either sort of buy coins or you can earn them, but it takes a really long time, or you can download this random app. And so there are a lot of people who are just randomly downloading apps and opening them one time to get the 50 coins that they needed for. So this is it's a weird, you know, economy. But what you hear is that it's really valuable to be in the top 25 in the App Store. And we wanted to do that because you get this organic lift, because people basically don't scroll past the top 25. People are often looking for new apps, and they'll go to the 25 and they're done. So if you get into the 25, the idea is you pay yourself to get into the top 25, and then you can sort of ride the organic lift to fame and glory. And lots of downloads.
So you made it to the top of the charts?
We made it to the top 25, and we didn't really see a lot of organic lift. You know, not a lot of people downloaded it on top of the paid installs that we bought. And the press didn't do a lot, and we even, you know, blasted our own site. And so everything that we did wasn't really, you know, it was not taking off as we had hoped it would. And that was... You know, I think the week after that happened, it was very disappointing. You know, it's hard to be.
I wonder why not. You know, there was a music festival here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I took an Uber to get there. It was a pretty expensive ride, actually, at that point. And then to get back, because there were so many people there, it was, what is it called? Surge pricing.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time I was using different car sharing, but it was surge pricing to get back home if I could even get a car.
Right.
Boom. Now, I'm not the only one in this big packed place that's going to Noe Valley, that's going to the mission. Someone's got to be going close there. I thought it would make so much sense, especially in that desperate moment, to say, I'll split a ride with you.
Right.
Why doesn't that work?
So basically, my theory on this is that you should never underestimate the consumer's interest in purchasing convenience. If something can be more convenient, more reliable, and faster, people will pay for it. A simple example of this is like the Keurig one-shot, you know, coffee, you know, things. It's very convenient. You just pop it in. You snap it down, you press a button, coffee comes out, it's fast, no mess, and it costs way more than buying regular ground coffee, but people are willing to do it, or willing to pay for it because of the convenience.
I see.
Uber, way more convenient than like trying to coordinate and find someone to who you might want to. It's awkward, you know, you have to wait, you don't know how long you have to wait. One of the big things about Uber and Lyft and sidecars is that they show the car coming. Yes, it's only a block away, I can't wait. The second piece of this is that the difference between sharing a ride and, you know, being a Lyft driver, for instance, is very different. Sharing a ride is that you are a participant in this activity, this festival. You're going just like everybody else. And, you know, you're trying to pick this thing up easily on the side. a Lyft driver, this is their job. This is their employment. I know a number of people who do Lyft because they're underemployed or they're unemployed, and this is like a way for them to make real money. And so, they call themselves ride sharing, and no, you know, knock on them, they're doing amazing work. You know, one of my best friends is the head of their community. I love Lyft, but they are not a peer-to-peer service. They are creating a, you know, in the same way that eBay sort of turned into this power seller dynamic where regular people who are just auctioning off, you know, their monitor or whatever, got squeezed out by these folks who basically had their garage filled with electronics and then they were blasting them out. It has to become a job for you. It has to be a marketplace that's peer-to-peer eventually bifurcates into professional sellers and buyers and consumers. You know, most people are not willing to do what it takes to become a professional, and then the professionals sort of knock out everybody else.
I see. So then even if I were to have a service that allowed me to get a ride home, it would be from an unprofessional person, which is the end of a concert where I'm ready to go home, is not what I want. And if I'm so cheap that I'm looking for a bargain, then I'll take the bus.
Right.
Okay. Things are tough here, and you're starting to understand the market. Then Craigslist does...
Well, we get a letter. We get a letter from Craigslist, and it was a cease and desist. And, you know, through all the things that we were doing on Craigslist, we were violating their terms of use. And, you know, it sounds a lot, you know, more onerous than it really was. You know, websites exist on the internet. We, you know, click yes to all the terms of use on every piece of software and never read it. And websites sort of are even weirder because they don't even show you. It's not like you have to approve the terms of use to load Craigslist on your screen. You know, it's just there, and then they can just, you know, say whatever they want on it. And they had a bunch of things like, you know, you can't encourage people to post into Craigslist from third-party sites. You can't post things into Craigslist that aren't related directly to the thing that you're trying. Very natural, very understandable for them. And at the same time, very understandable why we were doing what we were doing. And at the time, there were a lot of startups who were doing, you know, a variety of activities to kind of verticalize Craigslist, and sort of it was the sleeping giant. And the sleeping giant woke up when Padmapper really started taking off, the apartment finding site. And they actually got into a lawsuit with Padmapper and this other thing called Three Taps, which was aggregating Craigslist data. And they had hired a legal team, and the legal team's objective was to say, go out and find anybody who's doing anything on Craigslist that violates their terms of use, send them a cease and desist. And when we, you know, had all that great press from our iPhone app, one of the things that we included in the press release was the very, 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 very bottom, you can also find rides on Craigslist on RideJoy. And, you know, I don't know for sure, but...
That triggered their search, and boom...
Because we've been operating for a long time, you know, doing our thing, and no recourse. And all of a sudden it happened. We say, oh, crap. We say, we knew that this could have happened at any time. We always knew that. This was not like, what is this? We thought we were being okay. We knew that there was someday that there was a risk that this could happen. And our goal was always to get enough traction, do enough other things to get off of the Craigslist channel. Unfortunately, at that time, we had done the events, we had done the press, we had done the iPhone app. None of those things were doing as good as Craigslist. So we're in a tough spot. We find out that one of our YC peers has also received a cease and desist. We talk to them, we confide, we confer. They said that they spent $10,000 on their superb legal team, and it was determined that they had to desist. So we said, well... we better desist. We sat down with our team and we said, look, guys, this has happened. It sucks. We knew that this could always happen. It's unfortunate. We are not in a position. And we had sort of right before this gone through this little sort of putting the feelers out. We had, you know, raised $1.3 million. We had at that point spent $600 of the $1.3. We had $700 left in the bank, but we obviously had more people than we had, you know, 8 people essentially working full time for us, 2 as contractors, but still, you know, the same expenses. And we said, we talked to our investors and we said, what do we need to do to be able to raise a Series A in 7 months? And we said, what if we took our growth rate and, you know, made it 50%, you know, even more growth. So 40, 50% growth month over month, and we improved in conversions and we did all these things. Could we raise money? And we got a range of answers, and, you know, some of the answers were, you're on the bottom end of maybe. That was the best answer we got. The worst answer was no way in hell. I have portfolio companies that are making $1 million in revenue, and they can't raise a Series A, so you have no chance. But, you know, we're entrepreneurs. We're an optimistic type. We said, bottom end of maybe. We face worse odds than that. Come on, we can do this. But when the Craigslist cease and desist happened, we said, okay, we were trying to scrape our brains to grow more. Now we're not growing at all. This is not – this model of pure long-distance rideshare with this payment model is not going to fly as a venture-backed business. So we need to look at pivots. So we sat our team down. We said, we're going to spend some time. We're going to talk about pivots. And when I say pivot, I say the pivot in the way that it's used in basketball, which is you have one foot on the ground and you move your other foot. It has to be related somehow, either the technology or the market or the customer base, something. So,
but Gary Tan, mm-hmm. who's one of the partners at Y Combinator, actually advised a different path. He said, you know what? You guys should stop this, go talk to other Y Combinator companies, find out what problems they have, and just sell them solutions and look for problems that other people could have.
They did. He did. And it was really hard to hear that. You know, he advised us to do that sort of a little bit after we had tried, we looked into pivots and our, you know, we spent those 2 weeks and we looked at pivots around like carpools or like a social community for ride sharing, and we didn't feel like any of them were good. And then we realized that our team, we couldn't support the team that we had hired, especially if we didn't know what we were going to do. And so we had to let them go, and that was extremely painful. We helped them get new jobs. We gave them good severance. You know, we're still in touch with the team today. But we went into this wilderness, and that's, you know, some time into that wilderness was when we got that call from Gary Tan. We had gone back. It was like time warp. We had gone back in time to the first, you know, day of Y Combinator when we decided we didn't want to do this idea anymore. And we're back in our apartment. We had moved into an office, and then we moved out of the office. And then there's three of us again in this apartment a year and a half later. But everything's different now. Everything's different. We had raised money. We'd also gone through this, you know, somewhat traumatic, you know, sort of the challenge of getting to where we were and then seeing it all go away. And we didn't have a deadline. We didn't have a time frame where we had to do something. And, you know, the money was going to go up quick when we had 8 people fully staffed that we're paying market salaries to. But when we're paying ourselves founder salaries living in our apartments, it was pretty indefinite. You know, just the 3 of us, we could go for like a couple years, right? And so all of a sudden the time pressure is off, and we spun our wheels, right? The way I like to say it is that it's like breaking up with your long-term girlfriend and then trying to get married, right? It's trying to get married the next week, and it's really hard to do that. It's really hard to feel that same excitement, same passion for an idea again after you had it and you poured yourself into it and it didn't work. And that's when we called Gary Tan. We said, Gary, what do we do? We're so stuck. We don't have any ideas, or we have some ideas, but we don't have an idea that we all want to do. What should we do? And Gary was giving us some tough love. And he said, guys, we've got applications right now. I'm about to go and read thousands of applications. And you know what? All of these founders wish that they could be you. Wish that they could be you guys right now. YC founders with money in the bank, you can do whatever you want, right? And he was like, we were like, but what about our investors? He's like, screw the investors, you know? And he was an investor. So he's saying, you know, he says, screw the investors, do whatever you want. And that's when he said, it's doing a business can be very simple. All you do is you go up, you call up YC companies, you find out what their problems are, you find out, you fix those problems for them, you get them to pay you, and then you find other companies that have the same problem because they probably do, and you get them to pay you, and la-di-da, you have a business. And I think that that works for a certain category of entrepreneur, and it is not a value judgment, but I consider those, there are some types of people out there who see a glint of an opportunity and they just, a business opportunity, and they just go for it. And they
even
are
if
like,
they're not passionate about it.
Even if they don't have an inherent interest in it, but they see mechanically that, you know, their brain is excited about building businesses, about sort of like seizing customers and making money, and they just go for it. They're mercenaries, and not in a negative way, but just in like, that's how their brain is oriented, and I get it. But we, the three of us, and you know, and myself included, I was probably the most mercenary of the three of them, but I was not going to do this alone, and I was not going to sort of just say, screw you guys, I'm going to go out and do something. And so that was hard for us to hear, and that was not something that we were prepared to go down as a road.
And so what did you do with the money?
So, you know, we spent about 6 months sort of spinning our wheels and prototyping and coming up with stuff. And around March or so, we started realizing that we don't think this is gonna fly. That we can't keep doing this. I think you know, Calvin Redding probably keep doing it. I was so tired of dodging my friends, not wanting to answer questions about what I was up to. And not feeling like I was doing something useful. And I think that's so important. You know, one of the things that they say is that human beings, that deep need to feel useful. And I as sure as heck did not feel useful. It was like, you know, it's like first world problems, every day. And so we start talking about maybe an acqui-hire. Maybe someone could to pick us up. But lo and behold, just as we couldn't figure out a, you know, company that we want to start, we also didn't have many companies that we all wanted to work for. I mean, I don't think we didn't start this to get a job. You know, that's not why we're starting a company, to go get a job at Google or at Facebook at the end of this. And so we didn't really see a lot of and it's kind of weird to acquire a company in our stage. Normally, if they were going to do a talent acquisition, they would do it when we had maybe spent very little money, like $100,000, and they could sort of backfill that and pay us, you know, some cash bonus plus equity, or when you're down to nothing, and then they're, you know, you're kind of scrapping the company, but then they're picking you up again, but then no obligations. We still had $650,000 in the bank. It's an awkward amount of money. It's a little awkward. And so I think we talked to Airbnb, and they had recently acquired a number of companies, and they were not in the market for another small group of three guys who, you know, had done a startup recently. So we said, okay, well, then the only other option is to return the money. Because what are we going to do? You can't even blow. I mean, I'm sure you can blow $650,000 pretty quickly, but one of the most important things in Silicon Valley is your reputation, and especially as entrepreneurs who obviously were not going to be successful in this business, we wanted our investors to know that we respected their belief in us, and we did the best we could. And when we couldn't do it anymore, we, you know, stood up and announced it and made that return happen.
So you gave back their money, and you know what? I think that's the right move. There are zombie companies out there that are just being run by zombie entrepreneurs who just can't bring themselves to stop, but they're wasting their lives away. And I know of one specifically who's very well known, so I won't say his name, whose employees left him, and they feel like it's such a sad situation that he's continuing when everybody, including him, knows that there's nothing there. Again, past interview, if anyone is in that situation, wants to see a great turnaround story, it's, who was it? Brad Feld told a story of an entrepreneur who was in your situation, decide to give the money back to his investors and just take some breath and then go and figure out what to do next. That entrepreneur took a breath and ended up, refounding Netflix. What's the diet program? He basically launched a diet program using a name that was already out there, Nutrisystem. Great story and great reminder for me that the bullheaded go till the end is not always the answer. And so that's what you did. You now are doing growth at Percolate, a content marketing platform. Yep. I'm looking at it right on your website, jasonshen.com, where people can read about how to conquer fear and do epic shit.
Yeah.
Actually, shit, the I is gone. One more story before we leave, because I think this is a cathartic thing. Actually, we'll come back to Percolate, but a cathartic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Graham talked to you and said, you did nothing that we talked about in the whiteboard session. You've been feeling bad about that for a while, right? It's not like you're a kind of person who just blows off Paul Graham.
Right.
Right?
You'd be a very foolish person to blow off Paul Graham.
You know what? There's some jerk who on Twitter, maybe sometimes on Twitter people don't think, Paul Graham put up this post. Some guy just cursed him out in response. I said, maybe this is a troll. I looked him up. He's a decent person.
He's a real person.
He's a real person, decent. He works just a few blocks down from here. So, yeah, so there are some people.
Yeah.
You're not one of them. What was it that he meant by you did nothing that we talked about in the whiteboard session?
So that was in relation to the fact that with your – before you go out for demo day, Paul Graham works with you, and he says, and he kind of coaches you on here's, you know, he's coached hundreds of startups. This is the way that you should do it, based on your business, based on the situation, based on investors. Here's how you should pitch it. And what he basically came up with was, you know, saying you're basically doing carpooling, but carpooling sounds kind of boring. What you really want to, investors are going to be skeptical of this, so what you want to do is say something about how investors are too rich to understand the problems that poor people have, and poor people really need this, and this that this is for poor people, and there's a giant subterranean market for this. He actually said subterranean, and we said we don't want to say it's for poor people. We don't think it's for poor people. Is Airbnb for poor people? You know, like it's we saw ourselves as a peer to Airbnb, and we felt that there are lots of people who would enjoy doing this as an experiential thing. And I tried saying the word giant subterranean market and started cracking up. I couldn't say it. So we ended up pitching something totally different. And he, you know, after the day one, he came back and said, you did nothing, you know, he gives feedback on your pitch and he said, you did nothing that we talked about on our whiteboard. And I started to try to explain myself. He said, forget it. This is why we fund 63 companies. So if you want to shoot yourself in the foot, go ahead and do it. And that, you know, that sucks. And I've talked to other people about it. I've even talked to Jessica about it. Jessica says, you know, he's probably already forgotten about this. Don't even worry about it. You know, he has a million things on his mind. He just says things. The other thing that happened was that Paul Graham, even when we originally pitched that idea, he said, I don't think that's the best idea. I think you should keep thinking about ideas. And we turned around the next day and said, nope, we're doing this one. So those things sort of like stay with you, right? It's like this father that you disappointed and you want to, you know, he believed in us so much, right? He funded us. This first idea, no good. The second idea, still no good. We're still going to fund him. And then they came up with something. I don't really like it, and you're not listening to me. And now look at you. Didn't work out. We raised a lot of money. We raised more than the average company. And so at least on that front, we did something right. But ultimately, it wasn't right. And that doesn't feel very good.
And you're feeling guilty about it and feel it sucks.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, we had a lot of investors in us, but I think in particular because, you know, we feel that Y Combinator was such an integral part of us existing, it feels extra bad to let that person down.
Yeah. And I don't even think in the speed of building a company that what you were trying to do, of course, was I think you were trying to be authentic. I think you were trying to take the feedback as you could, but I think that Jessica Livingston is there for a reason, and she is, and Paul Graham has said to me, I think, here in Mixergy and to others, she's there and she has a sense of people that he... I don't think that he meant it the way... I don't think that he wanted to hurt you the way that he did. But and actually, the hurt comes from you because you care and you admire him so much.
Of course. It's, you know, I don't think that he meant to do any... He wasn't being a jerk.
Right. You feel like you were being a jerk, and that's the part that you regret, that you came across as someone who was being given so much, and you didn't show appreciation.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and then we had this final encounter where, you know, because there was a book written about our batch of Y Combinator, and they were shopping around that initial first chapter to pre-release the book, Vanity Fair picked it up, and we happened to be the first and second sentence of the book is, you know, Calvin Wang and Randy Pang are startup guys. Jason Shen is a startup guy. We lead this book, and so they publish this article, and they they're preparing to publish this article, and they do this photo shoot. We're doing a Vanity Fair photo shoot. This is in like early August, and we're getting like our makeup done. They brought in a Tesla. We're like sitting in a Tesla with Paul Graham and with Drew Houston and Arash from Dropbox, and like it's surreal, right? I mean, you do startup, you do all kinds of surreal things happen to you, which is one of the, you know, really cool things about doing a startup. But this is so surreal. And then what happened is that the article actually comes out in October. And by that time, we had already sort of like let go of our team, and we had, you know, gone through this whole Craigslist cease and desist. So the photo's coming out, and everyone's like, wow, that's amazing. You're in Vanity Fair. And like, there's this book about, I just saw a picture of you in a Tesla. And what can you say? That's the most like weird feeling in the world, where publicly you look like you're just unstoppable.
And people don't know underneath.
I mean, we didn't hide it. We told our friends, but we weren't blasting it off the rooftops telling everybody that because the site stayed up. Right. So that was, you know, there's these weird feelings, really weird feelings that happen.
I see the photo right here. I see Calvin Wang is right on the cover with a t-shirt that says share rides and spread joy. You guys might be more prominently featured in there. You are more than Jessica Livingston, the co-founder of Y Combinator, than anyone else. You did it though. Any regrets about having gone through this?
There's essentially, you know, there's always no way to know the counterfactual, but it has been very challenging for me to feel like there has been anything that I can regret about this whole situation, because every step along the way, I felt like I was making the right decision at the time that I was making it, right? Obviously, knowing what I know now, I would do things differently, but I can't at that time have known differently. And I'm happy with where I'm at now. I'm happy to be in New York and working at Percolate. And the connections that I've had, the experiences that I've learned, sort of the growth in my career is something that I definitely don't think I could have done without having done RideJoy. So to the degree that and I also know that tens of thousands of people used their service. Lots of them found rides to go where they wanted to go, and we got a lot of amazing, heartwarming stories. Were they, you know, $700,000 worth of heartwarming stories? I don't know. But that is the nature of venture capital, and, you know, I certainly am not – I don't feel bad for our investors in the sense that I don't feel like, you know, no one invested, like, we didn't have any, like, uncles who put in, you know, $50,000 from the retirement fund in there. These are all professional investors, and this is their job, or this is, you know, their very rich hobby. So, to that degree, I feel like we made a good run for it. We made our best effort, and we learned that
a ton. And on a personal level, mm-hmm. I only scratched the surface of the marketing, of the, I don't know if growth hacking is really the word to use anymore, but of your ability to to market, of your ability to get users in the door. I'm looking to see how you describe it yourself. Does growth at Percolate? So maybe the hacking part is the hacky part that we've gotten off of it. But you're doing growth at Percolate using a lot of the ideas that you've learned here. Would you do another startup after this?
I am definitely interested in doing another startup. I think that there's a whole. I totally understand now the notion of second time you're even more hungry to prove yourself. I think that there are a lot of things I will do differently in my next company. And, you know, I'm probably going to do more B2B versus B2C, which is what we did at Brightjoy. I think that I will probably mock up or, you know, build the initial prototype myself, sort of get, you know, enough customer traction that I feel like there's a real valid market and a real need there, and sort of bring on co-founders later who sort of share this vision rather than trying to emerge with the vision with the team first. Not to say that those aren't valid strategies, but I prefer to make different mistakes than to make the same mistake twice. And I'm looking forward to that. And I think that right now what I'm excited about is the opportunity to really kill it in my role at Percolate. Percolate is a company that's only 100 people, and it was like 40 people 9 months ago, so it's grown tremendously. And the marketing team, though, is still only 7 people, and it was 1 person 3 months ago. So I'm really experiencing that growth that you hear about with these companies, and that's something that I've never seen, right? I've worked in several early stage companies. I've worked at the Smithsonian, which is this giant organization, and now I'm getting a totally different experience. And you better believe that I'm sucking in every bit of information and insight and knowledge about what's going on here, and putting that into the database so that when I go out and do this again, I'm going to be armed to the teeth with everything I've got.
It's so great to have had you on here. The book, for anyone who wants a follow-up on this conversation, it's called Winning Isn't Normal. Let me see if I could give people a taste of what's in here. You know what? I was going to read some of the chapter titles. I don't think that's the way to do it. What's one thing that people can get out of this book? I feel like it's I don't know how to describe it.
It's a collection, for sure. It's a collection of a variety of stories and insights that I've done.
But they're connected, like the story even about where you try to fail by walking up to – sorry?
Yeah. And get rejected.
And sorry, get rejected. Excuse me, rejection. By walking up to someone, asking them for a piece of his pastry, and he goes, yeah, sure. And he gives you a piece of his pastry. But it's this I don't know. How do you describe it? Self-improvement isn't the word.
And I'll show you. There's a little picture here. We got this.
There's the book.
But Winning Isn't Normal, and I'll use Winning Isn't Normal because that's one of the essays in the book. And it is, I think, a fundamental part of this idea, which is that to win, you know, when you're growing up, you're often like, oh, I just want to fit in. I want to be normal. But then there's this opposite feeling of like, I want to win. I want to be the best. I want to like kill it. And the only, you know, those are sort of diametric feelings. If you want to do what everyone else is doing, you're going to get the results that everyone else is getting. That's natural. That makes sense. And it's safe to some degree. But if you want to start a company or to be the best person in your field or to do something that creates something and build something that other people haven't, you by necessity are going to have to take actions that are different from other people. You're going to have to, you know, if everyone wakes up at 9, you're going to have to wake up at 6. Not that you have to wake up at 6 specifically because, you know, for some stupid reason, but because you're going to have to find the things for yourself that are severely different from the rest of the population that are going to facilitate that result that you want. And I think the rest of the book kind of like goes into specific situations where that example might emerge.
All right. There it is. And the site, of course, is jasonshen.com for follow-up. Jason, thank you so much for doing this. Everyone else, thank you for being a part of it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you on here. I hope it won't be the last. Bye, guys.